Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn, and you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 22nd of September. Today marks the six-month anniversary of the enactment of the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act. The president's going to be traveling today to the home of a person with a chronic ailment who senior administration officials say is benefiting from the new law's repeal of lifetime coverage limits. Among the other provisions now in effect that will be highlighted today, the ability of children to remain on their parents' plans until age 26, a requirement for insurers to cover children with pre-existing conditions, and also a ban on various out-of-pocket charges for preventive care. Simultaneously, a federal judge indicated, during the same week, a federal judge yesterday indicated that he would give a green light to a lawsuit filed by elected officials from 20 states who are challenging the constitutionality of the new health care law and its requirement that most individuals obtain medical insurance. We're going to be talking about all of this this first hour of our program today. We'll have two guests with us, and they are Mary Agnes Carey, senior correspondent for Kaiser Health News. It is an editorially independent program of the Kaiser Family Foundation. They're not associated with the insurer, Kaiser Permanente. She most recently served as an associate editor for the Congressional Quarterly Health Beat, a daily report on healthcare policy, served as Capitol Hill Bureau Chief for Congressional Quarterly, and covered a wide range of topics for Dow Jones Newswires. She also worked at newspapers in Connecticut and Pennsylvania. Mary Agnes Carey, thank you very much for joining us this hour.
She's going to switch me up.
Whoops. Are we have her there? No. Okay. Well, we'll go back to her in just a moment, but she is with us. Also joining us, David Law. He's a professor of law and professor of political science at Washington University in St. Louis, and is today joining us by phone from Taiwan. Professor Law, thank you. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
And Mary Agnes, I think we have you there now?
Yes, I'm
there.
Here.
We go.
Excellent.
Okay. Thank you very much for being with us.
Sure.
Let's start with a six-month marking of the enactment of health care reform. The president is going to be talking about that today and highlighting what he feels are some of the better things from this Affordable Care Act. Can you give us just a little outline of what's going into effect right now?
Sure. For example, children under 26 could stay on their parents' health insurance plan. In some cases, if they can have a coverage at work, they couldn't go on the parents' plan, but in many cases, they could. There would be no copays for preventive services, no deductibles for the patients, no rescissions, no canceling of your health insurance policy once you got sick, no lifetime limits. These are sort of the things, the new consumer protections that go into effect as of tomorrow, September 23rd, the six-month anniversary of the bill, and this is what the administration's really out there talking about today.
Also this week, Professor Law, of course, a federal judge indicated that he would give this go-ahead to a lawsuit filed by elected officials from 20 states. They're challenging the constitutionality of the new health care law, the requirement that people need to get medical insurance. Two questions off the top here. One, how big is the opposition to this health care bill? And do you think that these lawsuits might go anywhere?
Well, I'm being based in Taiwan, I'm not quite as in touch with current events as I'd like to be. But there is certainly obviously very strong opposition to the healthcare bills, and the thing with lawsuits is you only really need one plaintiff to win in order to win the lawsuit. So the number of people who would like to see the law defeated, I guess, isn't terribly important. Whether they can actually win, I think they've got a shot. And part of the reason is the thing about American constitutional law is that it isn't necessarily the case that whatever the case law may suggest, it isn't necessarily the case that logic or common sense prevail. Whatever arguments five or more members of the Supreme Court feel like buying become the law of the land. So really this is an exercise in trying to predict what the court will do, I think. And there's a reasonable possibility that the plaintiffs might prevail, I think.
Do you think that's true, Mary Agnes?
Well, I am certainly no constitutional expert, and David is, but the take here in Washington is that Congress has full authority to say that individuals must buy health insurance, and that's really a key point of dispute, because many experts will tell you if the individual mandate is deleted from this bill, the rest of it falls apart. Insurers, for example, agreed to cover people with pre-existing medical conditions because they're looking at 32 million new people coming into the system, many of them healthy, that would help balance out costs. That would create a real problem for policymakers if, in fact, these plaintiffs prevail and the individual mandate is stricken.
Mm-hmm. It seems to me, and we followed this fairly closely, the point was brought up about mandated coverage, but it wasn't a huge criticism of this health care bill. Where did this come from?
Well, experts on both sides of the aisle have talked about this a lot. Now, of course, there are certainly conservatives that say in no way, shape, or form does the government have power to, or should the government mandate that people buy insurance, and if you simply offer other incentives, market incentives, tax credits, and so on, that people will step up and do it. But many healthcare analysts talked at length about how getting everybody in the system is critical to reducing its cost. Now, there's debate whether or not that will happen, but it's sort of, you know, you have to look back. The bill passed 6 months ago. Preceding that, you had something like 2 years of hearings on the Hill and experts coming up and saying things they've been saying for years. But the consensus among President Obama's viewpoint and many Democrats and healthcare analysts was we've got to mandate coverage to get everybody in. People are used to seatbelt laws. They're used to having to buy their automobile insurance, in many states requires it if you want to drive. So on that basis and on a policy basis, that was proposed and put through. But what's happened is, you know, there's the debate inside Washington and the debate outside Washington, and that's what we're seeing now as state legislatures and governors and, frankly, voters all over the country look at this and say, now, wait a minute, you're going to tell me I have to buy this? What's it going to cost?
Right.
How much is it? What are the benefits going to be? And the other thing driving this was this idea of the hidden tax, if you will, on the uninsured. Kathleen Sebelius, the head of HHS, has been talking a lot about this lately, that people who are covered pay for the people who are not covered. And is that fair? And that also is a part of the mix.
Mm-hmm. There seems to be an awful lot of politics involved in this, Professor Law. Those who are bringing the suits are Republicans, I think, except for one. And the judges who are hearing this initially tend to be conservative judges.
There is certainly a lot of politics to it, and some of the arguments, I think, are likely to fail any effort, for example, to prevent one citizen from being any effort a state makes to prevent its citizens from being forced to buy health insurance is going to fail unless they can somehow show that the federal statute itself is unconstitutional. So unless you have a winning constitutional argument, any law you pass, even if it's a state constitutional amendment, is more or less political posturing. And the thing to one thing to keep in mind here is the Supremacy Clause of the Constitution, in Article 4 of the Constitution, which gives the federal law supremacy over state law, actually doesn't draw any distinction between different kinds of state laws or different kinds of federal laws. It simply says that federal law trumps state law. So, for example, a regulation issued by a federal agency, say the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, both in theory and in fact trumps a state constitutional provision. So saying that you're Arizona and you amend your constitution so as to say that Arizonans don't have to buy health insurance, It doesn't matter if you do that or if you enact a statute. From a preemption perspective, if the state law is in conflict with the federal law, the state law has to yield.
Mm-hmm.
That's true whether you're talking about a state constitutional amendment or a regular law. Now, the constitutional amendment sounds impressive, but I can't imagine that any legislator who's with any legal knowledge doesn't understand that state constitutions are no different from state statutes. From a preemption perspective.
So it's true if we're talking about health care and if we're talking about immigration.
Yes, it's absolutely true. The one caveat, right, the one caveat is, does the federal government have the constitutional power to enact the law in the first place? If it does, then all state laws in the path of that federal law fail. They have to yield. Right? So the only way that states can resist the federal act is if they can somehow find some constitutional problem with the federal act. And I think the challenge there, I suspect the main challenge is going to be that Congress does not have the power under the Commerce Clause to force individuals to buy health insurance.
Mm-hmm. Did we have similar kind of lawsuits against programs? And I know there are differences, but there were substantial changes here, and it affected everybody in the country for Social Security, for Medicare. Do you know, Mary Agnes?
I do not know, to be frank, but I think that's a great question. And the one thing I've heard, and perhaps Professor Law want to talk about a little bit, is that this is, I think one argument used down in Virginia was this is uncharted territory for Congress saying the Commerce Clause allows us to mandate people buy health insurance. That's one of the reasons that the administration has asked to have these suits dismissed. And the judges have overruled them. Perhaps your point, maybe it was a political thing with conservative judges, but the other side of the argument is this is new territory for Congress, so let's have a legal argument. Let's get case law on the books and flesh this out a little bit and see what they do and do not have power to do.
Mm-hmm. Professor Law, would Medicare or Medicaid or Social Security be pertinent to this discussion?
Well, they're yes and no. So there are two main ways in which Congress can enact these big regulatory programs, right? One is under the Commerce Clause, which is Congress's power to regulate commerce among the several states. And the other is under its powers to tax and spend. And so if a federal program involves taxing people and then spending money on things, the Supreme Court's held that they're basically, the Supreme Court's been extremely reluctant to impose any limits on Congress's power to tax and spend. Limits on this taxing and spending powers are few and far between. Now, for decades, at least since the civil rights era, the court was also unwilling to limit Congress's power under the Commerce Clause. So, for example, the big example here is the Civil Rights Act of 1964. The Civil Rights Act of 1964 was actually enacted pursuant to Congress's power under the Commerce Clause. And the theory here was that Congress could get at racial discrimination in hotels and restaurants because hotels and restaurants affect interstate commerce. Now, lately, the court has taken, since the tail end of the 1990s, the court has taken a more restrictive view of Congress's power to the Commerce Clause, but the taxing and spending powers are still very broad. So Medicare and Medicaid can be understood as taxing and spending programs. So it's very difficult to limit a program that simply involves taxing and spending, but the problem is that you can characterize a requirement that individuals buy health insurance as neither taxing nor spending. Now, actually, so that gets us into a sort of a tricky thing here in that even if the opponents of the health care bill do win here, okay, ask yourself, does it really make any practical difference if, on the one hand, Congress says everyone out there must buy health insurance versus Congress says, if you do not buy health insurance, we will impose an extra tax on you, and then we will collect that money from you, and we will buy health insurance for you, right?
Right.
Functionally, there's not really, I mean, from a practical perspective, there's not much difference, but constitutionally, potentially, there is a difference.
Let's just talk for a moment, Mary Agnes, about how widespread the opposition is to this Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act and where the public stands on this issue. Would you say that there is widespread outrage about this act?
Well, it's interesting. People, for example, when you ask if you want to repeal the law, they say no. But then they say if you like the law, people seem evenly split with the edge going to people who oppose the law versus like the law. And then you start looking at the individual provisions of the law. Individual mandate, not so popular. Keeping kids on your policy, the parents' policy, till 26, popular.
Popular, I bet.
That is really the very complicated. When you look at the where people are and what they're thinking about the law, it's all over the place. And I think one of the complications here is that it is such a big law. It's so sweeping, and it goes into effect at various times. Today and tomorrow, people are going to hear a lot about new consumer protections in the health law and how they're going into effect. In a month or two, for most people, will be in their open enrollment at their employer for health insurance. New statistics, new studies have come out and show that health insurance premiums are increasing. Insurers say they're due to the law. There are other reasons to argue that they have nothing to do with health insurance law. But the bottom line is the consumer is sitting there looking at most likely a higher insurance premium. And they may have been thinking, now, wait a minute, this health law is supposed to reduce my costs. Over time, proponents of the law, President Obama, say that's exactly what will happen, but all the major provisions, Here we're talking about the health insurance exchanges, the subsidies to help people buy coverage, the Medicaid expansion. Doesn't start till 2014. And I think that that is part of the disconnect, if you will, with the public. I'm trying to understand what happens now, what happens later. And there's also been a very strong and vigorous opposition movement from Republicans who were talking about repeal and replace the bill. So it's really confusing for people.
Right. And why are those premiums going up?
Well, there are a variety of things. We all tend to use health care a lot. Insurance companies will tell you, they'll talk about rising prescription drug costs, rising hospital costs, other factors that are inching the premiums upward. Now, of course, hospitals and doctors would argue that point, but also there are people that say the insurance companies know that tighter restrictions are coming. For example, next year, they're going to have to follow something called the minimum loss ratio, that they're going to have to prove they spend at least 80% of your premium dollar on health care. So some people are saying, now, wait a minute, the insurers are getting out there and jacking up their rates because they know that the federal regulation is coming down the road. So there's even debate about that.
Right. Are they doing that, do you think, Professor Law?
I hate to sound cynical. It wouldn't shock me if they were. I wish I knew exactly what the health insurers' motivations were, but I have to admit here that I was born and raised in Canada, where we don't deal with private insurers. So I don't actually enjoy dealing with private health insurers, to tell you the truth.
It's a whole different ball game in Canada, isn't it?
It is.
Yeah, completely different. What difference does it make if you get more Republican representation and the Republicans should take over the House or the Senate or both? How does that change the equation here, does it?
Well, I don't. In terms of the ability to repeal and replace, as long as it doesn't take a lot for the Democrats to be able to prevent the Republicans from executing a repeal and replace strategy. Right? One thing about American government is more so than most forms of systems of government, it involves a lot of veto points. There are a lot of different groups that can, with even just a minority, block changes from occurring. Obviously, the filibuster is a relatively well-known way for even legislative minorities to block changes from occurring. So even if, you know, worst-case scenario for the Democrats, they lose a majority in the House and lose a majority in the Senate, they would also have to lose, they would also have to be reduced to fewer than 40 seats in the Senate, which looks rather unlikely at this point, and the Republicans would have to have a big enough majority, two-thirds majority necessary to override a veto from President Obama. So I wouldn't be surprised if, even with a nominal majority, the Republicans tried to execute that strategy, again, to score political points, but the odds of them succeeding politically, I think, are fairly low.
Mary Agnes.
Well, I think that you're absolutely right procedurally, but here's one thing that may be in the Republicans' favor. Polls suggest perhaps they'll get the House, as Professor Law said, them getting the Senate. Getting a 60-vote threshold in the Senate is pretty impossible. Seems pretty hard to do. We'll see. Elections are always surprising. But let's say Republicans take back the House. They can have a lot of oversight hearings, looking at the law, having Don Berwick, who runs the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services, having Kathleen Sebelius, who runs HHS, having federal regulators come before them and really drill down and look at this law and how are you implementing it and where is it fair or unfair. And even if it doesn't result in a change of law, that kind of oversight, that kind of focus could get out there in the public domain and, again, cause more concern with the public, raise new questions. So even if they can't repeal and replace the law, from the technical sense, I think they could do a lot of damage if given the opportunity.
And I would generally agree with that analysis, that it's obviously not good from Democrats' perspective if the Republicans take even a bare majority of the House. I think this would throw us back to a situation, well, it would throw us back exactly the same situation as we had in the most of the Reagan years, where you had the House under Democratic control and obviously the executive branch under Republican control. I think it would obviously make life more difficult for the Obama administration in terms of executing the bill, but I don't think it would make things impossible. It didn't stop the Reagan administration from playing a lot with federal law, and I doubt it would completely stop the Obama administration, but it would certainly make things uncomfortable.
The thing is, as you both well know more than anybody, we have been through this lengthy, over year-long examination of health care. And to imagine that going on for yet another year or more years makes you think, oh, please, our talk show topics are going to be so limited. It's we talked about all of this before.
But the complexity of it almost demands it, if you will. Mm. I mean, you're talking about something like, I think we're up to maybe 14-15% of the GDP, a sixth of the economy. It's one of those things that Washington does that really affects everyone's lives. And there'll be constant examination about the pros, the cons. And I think people will have to look at this law and ultimately be judged about, what does it do for me? And if most people feel good about it, mm-hmm. the law will succeed and be exactly what the president and Democrats want it to be. But if people don't feel that way, people feel that it's not reducing their costs, it's not helping their coverage, then it will not succeed in any way as proponents want it to.
To your phone calls in just one moment, 800-486-8655. We're talking about both the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act, which was enacted six months ago, and so there are provisions that are going to affect now this week, and we're also looking at the legal challenges, primarily those that have been brought to say that it's unconstitutional to require people to have health care coverage. We are talking about both of those aspects of this overall discussion of healthcare this hour of the program. We have two guests, Professor David Law, Professor of Law and Professor of Political Science at Washington University in St. Louis. Mary Agnes Carey is Senior Correspondent for Kaiser Health News and most recently served as Associate Editor for Congressional Quarterly Health Beat, a daily report on healthcare policy. We should remind you that Kaiser, that she works for, is editorially independent program of the Kaiser Family Foundation and not associated with the insurer. Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email address, talk@WPR.org. And this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up the second hour of our program today, this marks the 20th anniversary of the Ideas Network. Randall Davidson, who is considered the historian for Wisconsin Public Radio, has written a fascinating book that goes way back to the 1916-1915 when radio really started and how the University of Wisconsin was at the forefront of beginning radio. It's a fascinating look at some of the programs that many of you heard, I'm sure, early on, and a fascinating look at the beginning of radio. His book is 9XM Talking, WHA Radio, and the Wisconsin Idea. So he will be with us, hour number two of our program today. And we're also asking for you to help us take days off our fall pledge drive. Please, for every 800 donations we get, we will be taking one day off. And so we ask you to go to WPR.org to donate right now and take a day off of that pledge drive so we can have more talking. All right, let's go to phone calls, starting with Dave from Appleton. Hi, Dave.
Hi. I think the overall nexus of this debate in this country is that, unfortunately, we have a system where the people who use the service aren't the people who pay the service, and then in the middle you have a bunch of middlemen. As a small business person, that where our business does not provide health insurance coverage, and I'm on individual policies, I think that everybody should go on an individual policy, because when the consumer has to deal with all the problems in our systems and the costs that their employers are providing for them, if they don't see, when they have to deal with all the bureaucracy and the paperwork, we would have a Canadian-style system within a year. It's just that people who complain about the health care system or about the law, the current law, are the people who don't have to face the realities of our system because of basically a corporate nanny state watching over them. And let's call it what it is. Everybody go on your own, and then we'll see change.
Mary Agnes, thanks, really, Dave, for the call.
That's a really interesting point, because there are people who argue, really reflect what the caller is saying, that when you're an employer plan, all you really think about is your deductible or your copay or your premium. Do you really sit there and do you really think about your usage of health care? do you need this service or not? You don't usually have to hassle getting something paid. You might have an HR department that does it for you. The individual market is one of the toughest places to be for many people. For example, this whole rescission, the idea of getting your coverage canceled once you get sick, that's something that the law now bans, but it happens mostly in the individual market, not in the group market. So the sentiment the caller expresses is one that a lot of people have talked about. Do people really understand what their insurance covers, what it doesn't cover, how much it costs? That you don't really do that when you're in a group plan, so it's a very thoughtful comment.
Professor Law.
I am struck by the administrative burden that goes into maintaining health insurance. And particularly, you know, my wife is actually in this situation right now in terms of having to find an individual policy in a transitional period we're facing right now. But I don't actually know, speaking as a Canadian whose father is actually a doctor in the Canadian medical.
Oh, really?
Yeah, just ironically, you're getting, I suppose, two for the price of one.
Yeah, I didn't know this. This is great.
I don't know that it actually makes life harder for small business people if you move to Canadian system. It means actually that small business owners do not have to deal with any of this paperwork.
Do you think we're goofy in this country, the way our system is set up and all this intricacy in the debate, et cetera?
Well, I think anything I say here is bound to offend a lot of people.
That's
but
fine.
I think that by the standards of you know, the world's wealthy democracies, the American system is unusual in terms of how small a role the government plays in providing health care. And it is also unusual in terms of the administrative and paperwork maze that people face.
Right.
We have an extremely piecemeal system, which I think lacks transparency. And on the one hand, I'm not sure that the current act simplifies that maze. On the other hand, I'm not sure that it's possible to truly simplify things, because any change that's made, I think, arouses a lot of fear in people. And I have to say, I'm somewhat sympathetic to that fear, in that we're talking about an issue of both tremendous importance and tremendous complexity, where nearly all of the solutions that are bandied about are highly opaque to people who don't spend a lot of time studying the healthcare issue, such as Mary. So it's hard to sell people. And I personally don't think the Obama administration has done a terribly good job of explaining why this statute is a good thing and in what ways. But then again, it may not be possible when you're dealing with a population that increasingly gets little snippets of information. I think your listening audience is exceptional in terms of its patience and its willingness to hear policy debates hashed out in some detail.
Yeah.
But time is a finite resource.
Right.
And one thing political scientists know is they refer to people as being rationally ignorant, right? You don't spend your time following the media closely, voting, unless you feel you have something at stake. And typically people vote and people follow the news when they're worried about being taxed, and or they're worried about their children being sent to war. Those are the two things that catch people's attention. Everything else people tend to sort of ignore. Or also when they're out of a job. That's the other thing they tend to notice.
Mm-hmm. Points very well taken. Mary Agnes, it is way too complicated. Does it have to be this complicated?
That is a great question. And I think, unfortunately, the answer is yes, because of all the factors that they had to take into account when they passed the law and implementing the law. For example, most Americans get their coverage at work. It's a fairly large percentage, and so when you're drafting the law, you don't want to disturb the employer market, right? So that was one consideration they had. There are a lot of people out there that can't afford their health care coverage, or as your previous caller talked about, frustrations on the individual market. They can't find a coverage that works for them, or they're being underwritten. Well, how do you go after that problem? How do you, this idea now they're going to have also in 2014 these healthcare insurance exchanges, marketplaces where people buy coverage. They want to provide choice, but there's great complexity in that. The healthcare system is extremely complicated, in part because of the way you're building a bridge between as it exists now and you're trying to improve and tweak upon it, because as we've known so far on Capitol Hill, and perhaps you could say in the country as a whole, there hasn't been any consensus to have a Canadian-style system, for example. People don't seem to support that. They don't want that. So you got to work with the complicated system you have and fix it. So I think that it's just one of those unavoidable effects of trying to fix the healthcare system. It's going to be complicated. It's going to be tricky. And proponents of the bill say they are hindered by what they view as inaccurate messages from the other side, and also that you know, they'll use the word scare campaign, this kind of thing. Opponents of the bill wouldn't necessarily agree with that characterization. But the bottom line is there's a lot of information out there. You know, talking about people get their information in snippets, they get it in different ways. Are people going to the federal healthcare site, healthcare.gov, for example? Are they typing in their questions? Are they looking at provisions and how they affect them? I don't know if people are spending that much time on it. I think they might over time, especially as we get closer to 2014. But think about, just to build on this idea of complication, think about if Republicans were successful in repealing any pieces of the law. I'm not saying they will be. I don't think they'll have those numbers in Congress, but just imagine if that actually happened. Talk about complicated.
Exactly. Scott in La Crosse, hi.
Ooh, this was the perfect introduction to my question. I couldn't believe you just said that, Mary Agnes, and this is really for you. I am going to make the assumption here, and by the way, Kathleen, thanks so much for staying on this topic. You are a treasure to me. What I'm going to make the assumption that things will not be in any kind of a position for the Republicans to do their replace and repair, whatever they're going to call it, until they take office with a Republican president in 2013 and have control of both houses of the Congress. Let's assume that the Roberts Court does not decide to overturn this one. Now, that being the case, there's a couple of assumptions that I think will also have to be made, that probably the economy is going to be in bad shape or Obama probably would have gotten reelected. So you've got a Republican coming in with a bad economy, probably still an ongoing war in Afghanistan, and a platform by the Republican Party to repair and replace. And I guess my question is, repair and replace with what? And what would the position be? In other words, you've been talking about how people are removed from actually having these provisions be of benefit to a lot of them in terms of the rescission and these other things. But I mean, I'm hearing already that this being able to keep your kids on, especially in this economy, on your policy till you're 26 is popular. So all of a sudden, what are the Republicans going to do? Tear all this down and say, okay, and by the way, insurance companies, you're not going to get all these new customers next year, and we're going to replace it with, Mary Agnes, fill in the blank.
Well, you've just set up very nicely the challenge ahead for Republicans. Now, tomorrow, Republicans are supposed to unveil I hate to use the phrase contract with America because that's what they did in 1994, but it's something similar to that. They're supposed to come out and say, if we repealed health care, here's what we're going to do. I think you can only expect from that discussion an outline of things, talking points. Republicans have told me, I've talked to Republican staff and members, that they will have their own more workable solutions, in their opinion, to keeping children on their policies, parents' policy till age 26, not allowing rescissions, no annual limits, all these sort of provisions. There was a Republican alternative in the House advanced last year. Didn't do a tremendous amount to reduce the number of uninsured, from my recollection, but it didn't cost a heck of a lot either. That's the problem. To do these things, you have to cost money. So Republicans are going to be in exactly the position you describe if they take over. If they want to repeal a provision of the law, they have to explain to the public why they're taking it away and why their alternative is better. And as we know, it's always harder, much harder to govern than to criticize the majority. So they'll have their hands full.
This will be announced tomorrow, Mary Agnes.
Yes, it's supposed to be announced tomorrow. So you can see, for example, on the six-month anniversary of the health law, a lot of the press coverage will be drawn to that. Republicans want to make sure that they get their piece of it, too. So they're going to be talking about their solutions on health care, on the economy, and a variety of other things, because that, as you know, has been a big criticism of Republicans, that they haven't outlined their platform well enough to voters to say why they deserve control of the Congress in the next election. And that's what their hope is tomorrow, that they can explain that to people.
Mm. Thanks, Scott, always, for your call. Carolyn Madison, hi.
Hi. I have a question for a friend of mine, and I can't give a lot of details because I'm not the person involved. But what she was complaining about is that she has an individual policy, a high for catastrophic health insurance, and she was afraid her premiums with this policy, with this law, will go up, and she would not be able to. I understand that the law says that the people are forced to buy. If they're low income, they'll get some kind of subsidy. So since she's already got insurance, she wouldn't be qualified for that plan, as I understand it, and as she understood it.
Let me throw out a couple of thoughts. Number one, individual policies are most often regulated by the states, and states will have power in this bill to go after an insurer for what they think is an unreasonable rate increase. And the thought is that if insurers want to be in these health insurance exchanges, they're going to want to watch increases because they won't get the state regulators mad. The additional thing here is that state commissioners' power to regulate insurers kind of varies from state to state. And so in some states they may have a lot of power, in some states there may not. There seems to be a debate about how much additional power, if they get additional power, with the federal law. But to the affordability question, the subsidies are not going to be based, they'll be based on income.
Well, that's what she has the problem with, low income.
Right. If she has problem with low income, I mean, they're talking about subsidies up to 400% of the poverty level.
But if she already has insurance now, she won't be able to get on. That's just for people who are uninsured, as I understand it.
Well, I think that's a good question. My understanding is that, I'm going to go back and look this up, but I thought if you hit the income requirement, you could get assistance, period. But maybe you're right. Maybe it's only for people that don't have coverage. But I thought that people who hit the income number got help. Didn't matter whether they currently had coverage or not. But you've given me something to look up when we're done.
Mm. And another indication of how complicated this is. Let's go back to the mandate for a moment. Should it, and there's deep question about whether or not this should happen, but should it be deemed to be unconstitutional to have an individual mandate? Would you agree, Professor Law, that the whole health care bill would become completely unraveled?
Would the whole health care? Well, if I could first address the question of whether I actually think that the Congress has the power to force people to buy health insurance. Maybe I could start from there.
Okay, sure.
So the argument goes something like this, right? The Congress doesn't have the power to force individuals to act, right? But this distinction between Congress forcing people to act versus regulating what people are doing, this distinction is kind of both intellectually suspect and really unproductive as a practical matter, okay? So at some intuitive level, it makes sense to say, well, this bill forces people to buy health insurance, and Congress can't force people to do things. The power to regulate commerce is only the power to regulate people when they actually do something. But the thing is that a clever lawyer can always characterize an action as an inaction and vice versa, right? So I could then turn around and argue, well, actually, every time you go to the doctor, every time you buy medicine, you are engaging in commerce by buying healthcare services and healthcare goods. And so I can argue the healthcare mandate actually isn't forcing people to do something. Rather, it's imposing conditions upon people who are, in fact, engaged in a form of commercial activity. So that's the intellectual problem with this challenge, that Congress lacks the power to force people to act. I think better understood, what Congress has is the power to regulate commerce. And by not buying health insurance, your behavior affects interstate commerce. And if we need to put that in different vocabulary and say, well, what you're doing is you're buying healthcare services and goods in a way that is bad for interstate commerce, then so be it. But I don't see why the constitutionality of the Health Care Act should rest on that kind of logical or semantic distinction, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then as a practical matter, again, as I tried to suggest earlier, what is the point of forcing Congress to enact the same rules in substance by taxing and spending instead of allowing it to simply require individuals to buy insurance? But the problem is, I think, that as silly as the action versus inaction distinction is, if the court wants to buy that argument, if five members of the court want to buy that argument, they will.
More phone calls in a moment. Here's our phone number. Our guests are Professor David Law, Professor of Law and Professor of Political Science at Washington University in St. Louis, joining us by phone today from Taiwan. And Mary Agnes Carey, Senior Correspondent for Kaiser Health News. She served as Associate Editor for Congressional Quarterly Health Beat Before this, a daily report on health care policy. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Lots of health news or review, actually, of the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act, which became, which was enacted 6 months ago. So today and tomorrow, you'll see the president visiting many places talking about the important aspects of this bill. As Mary Agnes said, tomorrow you'll see the Republicans announce a different plan than the one that we have. And also this week, you have a number of attorneys general in the country who have challenged the mandatory insurance part of this reform, and so it's being heard in courts and will probably ultimately go to the Supreme Court. So we're talking about whether or not this provision may be unconstitutional. All right, our phone lines are busy, but sometime there will be an opening. 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. And this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. October 21st, we're going to be doing a live broadcast from the gorgeous Milwaukee Art Museum. I go there sometimes, and this is the truth, just to stand in the atrium, because it is absolutely beautiful with a view of Lake Michigan and the Calatrava-designed building. Ah, it's good. We're going to have Nancy Pearl with us. Nancy is our, we'll claim her, is our extraordinary librarian, and she has many books. She'll be talking about her new book, which is for armchair travelers and adventures all over the world, and she's done the whole Booklust series. She is an extraordinary person who loves books. They have influenced her life in a very dramatic way, and she remembers and can give valuable suggestions of directions that you should go for your next read. So she will be with us. Laurie Winters, who's the director of the exhibitions at the Art Museum and is so well-versed on so many aspects of art history and has brought some absolutely knockout exhibitions to the museum, will also be with us. We want to know if you're going to come to our party, and just so that we know how many donuts to get. I think we'll have donuts, and we'll have, oh, maybe we'll have something healthy, but we'll have some donuts too and coffee. So if you could please send an email to Rhonda and say, yes, I'd love to be there so we can plan your meal. It's not a meal, it's a snack. And her email is Fanning, F-A-N-N-I-N-G at WPR.org. We would love to see you there. We'll have just a great morning, and it's a live broadcast. All right, enough said about that. Let's go to Saeed from Green Bay. Hi, Saeed.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I think what makes the repeal of this bill compelling are not legal arguments, though those are ongoing, but there are economic arguments. For example, let's take the individual mandate. Whether the individual mandate is found to be constitutional or not is rendered moot by the fact that the penalties that are applied under the current law are too low. Individuals, rational individuals, will decide to pay the penalty and only take insurance when they get sick because there are no pre-existing conditions. Why pay when you're healthy when you can pay a penalty for lower cost, and then when you get sick, you can take the insurance? So that's one issue. Let's go back to what the administration is going to be touting out as their achievements on this, which is your kids can stay on your insurance until they're 26, no lifetime limits, no deductibles for preventive care, et cetera, et cetera. These are all wonderful things, but no one's decided how it's going to be paid for. And by definition, these mandates will raise premiums on by insurers. Now, you might think that insurers have a great profit and that these will just come out of their profits. I, as a provider of healthcare, have spent my lifetime fighting insurance companies, but I'll be the first one to say that the profit margins in the health insurance industry, when you rank industry sector by sector, fall somewhere below the mean. And to tell you, to give you an example of why that is true, if the health insurance industry was so profitable, companies would be racing to get into it. Companies are racing to get out of it. In fact, the diminishing number of insurers is a serious problem. And what makes this bill destructive and untenable is its lack of sound economic underpinnings. This is going to be paid for by a $500 billion cut in Medicare. Now, I take care of Medicare patients. and I take care of them, even though from a business perspective, I would be better off not doing that, given the level of reimbursement that there is. Now government is going to cut that by $500 billion at a time when a tsunami of Medicare patients are going to be arriving as the baby boom generation retires.
All right, Saeed, thank you very much for your call. Let's start with Mary Agnes in a response.
Mary, I think it raises a lot of interesting points. Number one, on the individual mandate, that is an argument that's out there. The penalty is way too low. This is a political hot point, and everybody knew it. So when they put it in the bill, they wanted to gradually increase the penalties. I wonder if Democrats remain in power and have, you know, continue their implementation of the bill, if this is something Congress could revisit over time, because the exact thing he's talking about, people may not just say, I'll pay the penalty and not get health insurance, and then you don't achieve the broader risk pool that you want of healthier people coming in. How are they going to pay for all this? That is a big debate. Insurers will say, look, if you make us cover preventive services with no co-pays or deductibles, we can't do annual limits. We can't do individual, annual limits will gradually be phased out, but lifetime's what kicks in right away. Bottom line is insurers will say all this stuff costs money. We've got to increase the premiums. And as we know, the bill gives insurance commissioners and the federal government may have some backup power on this to look at premium increases and see what's excessive. This is going to be an ongoing debate. The Medicare item he just raised, this has been in the discussion a lot. What proponents of the bill, writers of the bill said, they look at a panel here in Washington, people may have not heard about Medicare Payment Advisory Commission, and they look at recommendations they make on Medicare payment. There is an argument about Medicare Advantage, private health plans in Medicare, that they were overpaid, that the government, Medicare pays something like 14% more for somebody in private insurance in Medicare than they do in the fee-for-service system. They're taking a lot of money out of the private Medicare plans. They're looking at other providers. Home health industry is an example. MedPAC was saying these folks are over, you know, they have a high profit margin. There's great access for Medicare beneficiaries. They can go ahead and take some of those payment reductions. And the other thing to throw in here is that some of the providers agreed to payment reductions because they wanted to be on board with health reform. They looked as an inevitable political outcome of last year, and they're looking for the new business. Insurers agreed, hospitals agreed to take some payment reductions. Drug companies are going to cover Medicare prescription drug costs up to 50% when people hit this donut hole. So, and there are also additional protections in Medicare. There's additional spending on Medicare and prevention, for example. So that net reduction is lower than $500 billion. But nonetheless, that concern about the reduction in Medicare spending, no matter how it's based in data that people may or may not agree with, that talking point is one that people talk about a lot, and they think politically it could hurt the president, it could hurt Democrats, it's going to play out in the elections, and it's going to be with us for a while.
What about his comments concerning the insurance industry? I haven't heard much of that. Are you familiar with that, Professor Law? Are they indeed getting out of the business because they're not making enough money?
Is there any empirical evidence that they're in fact exiting the health insurance business?
I don't know. Is that true, Mary Agnes?
I don't know about them leaving. I do see a lot of press releases and so on issued by the trade group that represents insurers here in Washington talking about their low profit margins. The problem is their CEOs are getting paid a ton of money, and that's what people focus on. They look at their base pay. They look at their bonus pay. They may look at a market where a particular insurance company has asked for a significant rate increase, and they'll go back and look at the CEO pay. So that's really sort of the PR game, I think, that's hard for the health insurance companies. Even if their profit margins, you know, they say they're as low as the caller's talking about, and I've seen that written and discussed, but a lot of it is right. The CEO pay that angers people.
Mm-hmm.
And let's not forget, too, I mean, was it HealthSouth recently, the CEO who, I believe, was he convicted of criminal charges, I think, for embezzling millions and millions of dollars from the health insurance industry? I think if the Obama administration really wanted to mount a PR offensive against the healthcare industry, it could, but health insurance industry, it could, but for obvious reasons, doesn't want to. If I could loop back to a point that Saeed made about whether the fines are adequate, that's an excellent point. And in fact, I think the problem is bigger than that. From a rational, calculating bad man perspective, you have to take into account first the size of the fine and also second the likelihood you'll be caught, right? So even if you make the fine bigger, you still also have to worry about the issue of whether people who are not, people who are skipping the insurance mandate are being caught. So just to throw out an interesting idea here, if you really want to harness the self-interest of the insurers here, possibly what you could do is you could say to insurers, look, for every, we'll turn you into bounty hunters for every person you catch who isn't complying with the mandate, right? If you catch them, you can get either a cut of the penalty if they pay the penalty, or you can allow them perhaps to apply the penalty toward a premium with you, the successful bounty hunter.
Oh, thank you both so much for being with us. It was a very interesting, and it remains a complicated issue and such an important issue. But my golly, there are so many parts to all of this, aren't there? Woo!
It's what I think every day.
Yeah, I'll bet you do. I'll bet you every day. Thank you both. You were terrific guests, and I hope we can call on you again.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Our thanks to Mary Agnes Carey, Senior Correspondent for Kaiser Health News, and Professor David Law, Professor of Law and Professor of Political Science at Washington University in St. Louis, to be with us this today and tomorrow, marking the six-month anniversary of the enactment of the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act. You'll hear a lot about this, the aspects of the law that the administration wants to tout as they will talk about it today, and Republicans tomorrow will be announcing a plan that is quite different than the plan that we have now. Thanks to Chrissy Pease for producing this interesting program, and thanks to Chrissy as well for on-air production in our downtown Milwaukee studios from the Royce Federal Building. And thanks for all of your calls. Sorry we couldn't get to all of them, but these are complicated issues. We'll return following the latest news coming up in just a moment.